Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about two new movies that are out, Censor and Zola. And it's interesting, Mike, I think that both of these movies sort of lend themselves to a general discussion about censorship in general in terms of the movies. Now, Censor, the first movie that we're going to discuss, obviously gives away its game plan in the title. And the premise, I think, is fascinating, that it's about a woman whose job it is to watch the worst of the worst films that are out there and to approve or disapprove based on some very fixed criteria. And actually, I will say right up front that one of the interesting things that I thought they did really well and was sort of like a peek behind the mirrors thing was how seriously these people took this job. But they are watching things that I found hard to sit through and kind of begs the question of what is too sick for us all to watch. So why don't we start there, Mike, with this movie? And by the way, you saw it in the theater. I paid good money to Amazon Prime to stream this, just so people know it's available out there if they're interested in the movie. But in terms of censorship in general, and this movie in particular, Mike, what do you want to say to start off?
Well, just to cut to the chase on it, I found the film really disappointing because the premise is so good. I mean, it's really a terrific premise for a discussion about censorship. What's important to say, adding to what you've already mentioned, is the issue of context. In terms of the setting for the film, it's set in United Kingdom. It's taking place during the 1980s, and that's what's crucial in this respect, because there was a real concern. I mean, the British have had a censorship board for decades and decades, but in the 80s, there was a real concern that became a big political discussion. Namely, when you think about it, it was the 1980s when the home video market took off. And so it would be one thing to go to a movie theater and, whatever you've spent, Marie, whatever the equivalent would be, is paying your good hard-earned money to see this trash, right? And whether it offended you or whether you imitated it in a nefarious way, whatever your response was, it was your choice to actually, take the tube, take the subway, go to the theater, see the film. But the home video market, now the film is coming into your home. One way or another, it's been brought into the home, right? And so the particular genre or type of film, which, Marie, you alluded to, were what the Brits referred to as video nasties. These were exploitation films that have no redeeming value. You'd have to be really hard-pressed to explain or somehow defend them. They really are nasty. And for people who frankly enjoy watching blood and gore and, fill in the blank, all kinds of stuff, what do you do with a film like that? So what I did like about the film, and I didn't like much about it, but I did like that basic premise, that here's this woman whose full-time job it is to watch this stuff all day long and to rate it and to mark places where it should be cut or, advisories, whatever. And Marie, to your point, which is very well taken, she takes her job very seriously. In other words, even though jobs like that sometimes are patronage positions, or somehow you're on the public payroll and this is the job you get, whatever, she actually does, in an ethical way, take it very seriously. And where the film, although the film is not exactly a barrel of laughs, it does have some humorous or at least smile-inducing moments. She's sitting there watching these horrible movies all day long, and she has a notebook. And the one notation she makes that made me laugh out loud was she wrote, "Eye gouging must go." And this is where she specifies what can stay and what can go. But Marie, to your larger point, in terms of censorship, should there be any? How should that be handled? It's one thing to have advisories, and I think most people would be in favor of that. We have our movie rating system in the United States, and it's rated G or it's rated R. You have a sense going in or not going in as to what you're going to see. What we're talking about in this particular film, Censor, is like a step beyond that, because she quite literally has what I call the scissors. In other words, she really can, reject something or flag it in a way that causes problems. And, even though I have no defense for these terrible movies that she's watching, still somebody made it, who has at least business in mind, if not art. And, to have somebody come along and say, well, we're not going to get the seal of approval, or they want to cut 10 minutes. Those become really nasty in their own way disputes, right, between filmmakers and film bureaucrats who are government bureaucrats. So think about it that way. Do you want your government telling you what you can put in your film, and moreover, what you as a tax-paying citizen can watch? I mean, can't you argue back that, well, I may have sick taste, but it's my taste. I don't want the government telling me. So let me toss it back to you so you can answer all these difficult questions.
Well, I've always maintained that if we were ever, overcome by a fascist government, that the first thing I would want to do is get myself on one of those boards that decides what's too disgusting for other people, because I don't want anybody telling me what to watch. And I'm just convinced that I would, only let the best stuff through and hold the line. But I had no idea stuff like this existed. So this was actually sort of a shock. I mean, you always sort of suspect, and you make a good point, Mike, about home video, because all of a sudden stuff that was really truly underground and traded amongst enthusiasts now has a place to, actually get a rating. And, to your point about how seriously they take it, that was one of the things about the film I thought was really well done. There's actually a point where she has the main character, who, by the way, this is the advantage of watching at home with Amazon Prime, is you can make yourself notes without having to bother anybody around you. So I was struck by the fact that she reminded me of Dana Carvey's church lady. She's, wearing glasses on a chain. She's actually got an actual bun. I mean, she is literally the before picture, before they take the librarian to the hair salon and, she suddenly turns into this bombshell. She literally picks at her nails, like literally nitpicking. And her parents are sort of this overlay of this weird kind of 1950s artifice where, let's just try to have a lovely meal. And meanwhile, there's just all this terrible stuff happening under the surface, that one of the things being that her sister was murdered and she would like to get to the bottom of it. And she thinks she sees clues in some of the stuff that she's watching. So at one point she's going back to work when she's not there that day for that particular viewing and bursts in, with her findings, her discovery. And her coworkers are offended. Like, we're in the middle of a screening. And, there's like horrible stuff happening on the screen, but they're taking it deadly seriously. That part of it I thought was very well done. I think it did not live up to what I had hoped it would do, which was say something about how desensitized you must get after watching this stuff day after day after day. And to your point, Mike, the eye gouging thing was something I noticed too, where she no, that's just too realistic. That's got to come out. And so you're thinking, this is a job where you're actually parsing whether, no, that's fine. But no, at that point, you've crossed the line. That I thought would have been just a much better movie.
Well, you know what? To follow up on that, part of the premise, which is quite intriguing, is that she's watching all these dreadful films, or all these gory films. And she thinks, her sister had disappeared mysteriously years earlier. I don't want to have any spoilers here, so I'll be careful how I phrase this. But basically, the sister disappeared years ago. The parents have more or less come to terms with, they're not going to see her again. But our censor, watching movies day in, day out, thinks she sees or recognizes what her sister would look like now as an adult. And then, it's a bit of a mystery story at that point as to can she track down through the film and the filmmakers, if indeed this is the sister. I don't want to spoil that, but what I will spoil in a way is, any enjoyment within the film. One reason I didn't like the film was the premise made by many government critics and puritanical types and just ordinary citizens in the 80s with that home video market was, people are going to see these dreadful movies and then it will be mimetic. I mean, this is one of the old arguments with film censorship. They're going to see these acts of violence and just extreme behavior, and then they're going to imitate it. They're going to go out and do this themselves. Now, the censors, by job description, are meant to somehow regulate so that, if there is a mimetic impulse, they can channel it, control it, stop it, censor it, right? But the one question that's raised by the film and never really explored is, our protagonist, and her name is Enid, and I love the way you described her hair in the tight bun and all, she is wound tight, right? And so as she starts checking out, if indeed this is her sister, the film never really explores a crucial point, namely that if watching movies like this makes you violent yourself or act out in irrational ways, is Enid herself going to start acting this way, if even with a high-minded purpose of finding her sister? I mean, you can parse it various ways, but watching the film, you feel like the filmmakers themselves at the scripting level hadn't fully thought that through. You know what I mean? As to, well, what are we to make of Enid at this point? Is she a vigilante? Is she this or that? Is she as bad as the people in the films themselves? And again, not to spoil anything in terms of how it all turns out, but it's just sort of presented to us. It's really, not really explored in any kind of depth psychology manner. In like manner, a disappointment for me was the fact that because it's set in the 1980s, this is when Margaret Thatcher is the prime minister, And British filmmakers certainly were almost all well to the left of Margaret Thatcher. And indeed, that becomes subject matter for a lot of the best British films in the 80s or films set in that era as to, you know, left versus right and up against Thatcher, who certainly was open to censorship of various types. And yet, you know, in the film, very briefly, you'll see mention made of street protests against Thatcher's government and so on. But that is a dangling thread in the film. It's there, but it's not really developed or explored in any way. In fact, it's frustrating because it's like there just enough that you wish it were either taken out completely or more fully developed. Another reason why I think the film doesn't have enough thought put into it as to what exactly are we saying here? What are we as an audience to make of all this? And now that I'm complaining, if you'll let me rant a little bit longer, yet another major complaint I had, it's had to do with the tone of the film. I'm not, you know, opposed to films that have a really cool, dry, detached tone, but this film really is monotonous that way. There's very sluggish pacing. It has a kind of grayish monochromatic palette in the cinematography. It just is kind of dreary to watch. And you don't really have enough sense of Enid as a person. And I know that's partly the point, a kind of empty life, if you will. But my goodness, at feature length, that's a bit of a grueling endurance feat for the audience to stay with her all that time when you don't know enough about her. And at least from my perspective, I don't care enough about her. I mean, I felt that I should care about her, but I never really did. She was almost like a blank slate in a lot of ways. What do you think, Ray? Because I think the tone of the film is, as much as anything, what defeats it. The interesting premise gets scuttled, I think, for various reasons, but it's just simply not very interesting to watch at times.
You know, I think you hit on something with the tone, because had they left out the subplot about, you know, the sister who had been abducted, it would have been an interesting study about this very clinical-minded person. And like you said, at some point, does something, you know, does she become so desensitized by what she's seen that she sees the boogeyman everywhere, which is where I just think they decided, well, you know, what would be the ultimate boogeyman that she would, you know, all roads would lead to this. But I do take exception to the idea that, you know, we are what we watch to that kind of extent, because I want to know why, if that's the case, why watching sitcoms doesn't make any of us funnier.
Well, thank you for saying that. Actually, you're very funny, so I know you've been watching sitcoms. But no, this is a point that John Waters always makes because of the extreme nature of his early films in particular. He was always up against that with censorship, where people would say, well, people are going to watch your movies and go out and do things like that in terms of, you know, the violence and, you know, extreme sexuality, if I can put it that way, just all kinds of out there behavior. And John always said that, you know what? He said, I put murder in my films so that I don't go out and murder somebody, you know, that it's vicarious that way. And so he directly challenged that notion. And, you know, I challenge it too, that somehow watching, because I've watched a lot of gory movies, and I must confess, some of the movies like what we see within this movie, you know, in the grindhouses in downtown theaters. I mean, I've seen movies like that. And I can say, in all honesty, not that I'm a Boy Scout, but I haven't done any of those things. You know, I've got a pretty clean slate. So in other words, you know, because you watch that or even watch a lot of it, doesn't ipso facto mean that you're going to go out and do it. So that mimetic, that bit. But that was a large part of the argument at that time in Great Britain, that people would go out and do this. And so, you know, again, this is, Maria, you raise a really good point, because in talking about censorship, this is the battle that goes back and forth. Those who say that it's somehow mimetic, that if people watch this, it will infect them or affect them somehow, and they'll go out and do this. The counter argument is, well, no, actually, if anything, you know, there's a kind of vicarious factor that, you know, you're going to watch, and I'll put quotation marks around enjoy, but, you know, it's somehow you'll work it out that way. And because you work it out that way in a simulated way, you're not going to go out and do this yourself. So that's sort of the back and forth. Now, within the film, I don't want somebody in the film to make a stand up and deliver academic lecture like I am verging on. But I was hoping for more of a more active discussion of points like that within the film. You could have characters go back and forth in their own way, and that would work. But the film just kind of goes on in this, I call it like a droning level, and doesn't really explore that.
You know, since you slipped a little bit of Latin in there, I'm going to pivot quickly over to Greece with Aristotle, because you raised a really important point that for some people, these movies are a way of acting things out rather than doing. Aristotle famously said that that's why people like theater, because you don't have to actually go to war. You can go to the experience of it, and it's cathartic. And I think a lot of these movies are cathartic. So maybe it's a safe place to explore these tumultuous feelings that people wish they did not have or are glad that they have and want to somehow celebrate them in their own home with their videos. However, I did not find this entertainment. I found it disturbing and upsetting. So, and this is the other beauty part of watching it at home. When you see the really terrible scenes coming, you can at least mute it so you don't have the sound coming at you at the same time. But I do want to say, Mike, before we go on to the next thing, I did think it did a good job of at least introducing the idea of doxing and being confronted with the press when you have a controversial job. And I thought there were some interesting things done with the colors. You know, they have these super saturated pastel colors. And then, of course, at the end, they kind of give you this utopian overlay with something happened underneath, which I thought was sort of interesting. But overall, I thought it was creepy and sadistic. And this was a complete miss for me, but it had a lot of promise. What do you think?
Yeah, to cut to the chase on this one, I really hated this film, partly because the premise was so promising and it just fell apart on so many levels. And I tend to be verbose as I explain why, let me count the ways why I hate it so much. But I was reassured in some ways to feel I wasn't the only one who felt like that. So I went to the New York Times review, which is actually very perceptive, and they nailed it in just a sentence. I wish I could nail things in a sentence like this. Here's what the New York Times critic said. Censor gazes on movie history with style and commitment, but little apparent purpose beyond simulation. And that's what I was, they go on to say more about it, but that's what I was getting at, that it does give a sense of what these actual dreadful movies are like, and it does give a convincing sense of how a censor would work. And Marie, you're right, the bureaucratic quality of what it's like to work in an office like that. Some of that, was not quite ha-ha funny, but you had to smile a bit at the bureaucrats doing their job. But it never really goes beyond what the critic in the Times referred to as simulation. In other words, it kind of recreates what that environment is, but there's not really a point of view. There's not really judgment. There's not active discussion. It just presents it to you there. And then again, without spoiling anything, by the time you get to the end of the film, I found it borderline unconvincing at that point. So it went beyond not caring about the character as much as I should have. I wasn't believing a lot of what I was watching at that point. It just seemed like the film itself was going off some kind of deep end. What do you think?
I agree with you. One final question about it. Since you saw it in the theater, were there a lot of people with you and did anybody walk out?
I think that was a screening quite a few weeks ago at this point when theater attendance was on the small side. And the reason I say that is there would have only been a few other people in the theater. And frankly, I would have been afraid to ask them what they thought of it. What if somebody told me that's the best movie I've seen this year? What would I say at that point? I would want to be further away than 6 feet. You know what I mean? So I just slithered out of the theater when it was over. I didn't want to talk to anybody at that point because, I had a sense of professional obligation. A new movie, I'll go to see it. That's my excuse. Right. But should I turn to the other person and say, what's your excuse?
That's a great rejoinder, Mike. Thank you. So let's switch over to Zola. And the reason I thought it kind of matched Censor for topicality is when I saw this, the theater was pretty decently full and someone had brought their baby in a baby carriage, which is always a bad sign, because, babies notoriously never make it through the movie. Well, that baby slept through the whole thing. And after watching it, I thought that is as old as you can be as a child without being completely shocked by what's on the screen. Having said that, you don't actually see any nudity. You just see glimpses of a world that most people don't know anything about. So I will just tell people that interesting thing about the whole story is it's based on a Twitter thread where this stripper named Zola, a real person, we met somebody while she was waiting tables at Hooters, and this person immediately befriended her and invited her to go to Florida to, make money, and, they would do their stripper act, and she doesn't realize what she is getting herself into. But it's a road movie. It's about this sort of underworld. You do see a lot of stripping and twerking. You don't see really any nudity, but it has things to say about trafficking and about posting things online. In some ways, I think it had a lot to say. I'm not sure it fulfilled all of its promise either. What was your take, your initial take on the movie, Mike?
My initial take was very close to yours, actually. When you and I talk about films, we invariably oftentimes talk about literary sources for something. This is based on a Henry James novel, and what wonderful production design that Merchant Ivory have and so on. This is the first instance, or certainly one of the few instances I can think of, where a film has as its literary source a Twitter thread. I mean, it's just really, beyond being amusing to hear that, I think in some ways that's to the film's advantage. There's a kind of topicality, certainly in terms of social media, of the moment and so on. But correspondingly, I found the film, though really intriguing at that level alone and very entertaining, I found it superficial and uneven and not fully thought through. And I thought, well, maybe that comes with the package. You know what I'm getting at? Maybe it's just, you know, you have this basis and you know, you're going to get viewers, you're going to get an audience for something like this. Because as Marie, as you said, think about the subject matter. You know, how can you like, you know, yawn at subject matter like this? Because, and it's actually very convincing. I mean, even if I hadn't known it's based on this woman's actual experience, it plays convincingly. You know, you're Zola, title character, you're a waitress in a restaurant, one of your customers, you know, you're making small talk. And it turns out that, well, lo and behold, you're both strippers. You know, I guess only in the movies, right? You go to the cafe, and you're a stripper too. And Zola takes her job very seriously. And this is where I kind of smiled. There are scenes where Zola is in her apartment and she's exercising. She's practicing on the pole, if you will. And, you know, I thought, well, goodness sakes, I don't have that in my living room. But, you know, she's got the pole there and she's dancing with, and she really does take it seriously. And one reason why, I mean, although I'm ultimately disappointed in the film, there's a lot to engage one here. It's really energetic. It's really just, you know, what I call like spiky. It's just full of fascinating scenes and action and like a road picture, right? That just keeps going. It doesn't always convince. It's not very smooth in places. It is ultimately superficial, but boy, does it hold your interest. Like you, Marie, I saw it in a fairly crowded theater. The audience really went for it. I mean, you could just tell like audible responses. People loved it. And so that actually affected my response. Had I seen it by myself, you know, I might have been cooler about it. But when the audience is revved up like that, how can you not be revved up? But let me sort of, you know, hit an essential point here. And one reason why the Twitter thread origins maybe indicate that it's going to grab your attention, but not fully follow through on it. This title character, Zola, she meets this other young woman, and the other young woman is like really out there and really kind of, I don't want to say dangerous, but sort of on the edge more. Zola's a very commonsensical, you know, it's like, well, I work as a waitress and you know, my second job, if you will, is as a stripper. And it's just like, well, okay, when you fill out your taxes, that's what you list as your occupations. You know, she's kind of like her head's on the shoulders, right? And the fact that the film itself is not salacious, there's surprisingly little nudity in the film. And I think that's deliberate. And I think it's admirable in the sense that the film does have a kind of agenda, if you will. It has themes it's dealing with. And it's not looking to be like the gory movies we were just talking about in Censor. It's not looking to, you know, titillate the audience that way. It's dealing with other things. But again, the point I wanted to make by way of a major disappointment in the film is, so Zola and this other woman, they take off ostensibly to go to Tampa, Florida. And it's very much a Florida movie, believe me, we can talk about that. But they think, we're going to work in a club, you know, and we'll dance and we'll make a lot of money and have a good time and so on. And big surprise, you know, well, you can make a lot of money dancing, but also there's prostitution. And, you know, not to cut too far into the story at this moment, but the fact that this is more than Zola had banked on, right? The disappointment for me is that Zola is a near cipher as a character. Ironically, she's a narrator of the film. She's on screen in almost every scene. She's there, right? But oftentimes she's passively there. And I just kept thinking, well, maybe she's such a genuinely passive person that I should accept that at a realistic level, that she just gets in deep and she looks around, doesn't know what to do. But you know what? It was very frustrating because there are a lot of scenes where you would think she would either act out, do something, say something, or because she's the narrator, at least say something more to us, right? We're the audience that she's addressing. But oftentimes she's just sort of there with a blank look on her face. Well, what'd you think of that? I just found it puzzling after a while that our protagonist, the title character, for me was a near cipher at times. I mean, I do want to know more about her, not just personal background, but like ethically, how she's responding.
Well, I do think that it's interesting that she sort of provides the narrator point of view. And as the, you know, the viewer, you're concerned about the danger that you see creeping, that she seems to just sort of take for granted as sort of background noise. One thing I thought it did really well was this whole idea of social media that, you know, she sort of takes this ingenue, if you want to go there, under her wing and explains to her that, no, this is not how it's done. Look, you take these kind of pictures, you put this kind of information out, and then, you know, suddenly it makes more money. And there's all these noises going on throughout the movie that indicate you know, a tweet coming in or a Facebook post being made. And I thought that was also very of the moment. I will say one of the criteria I have whenever I watch a movie is, have I already seen this movie before? And I will say, I did not feel like I saw that movie before. It did feel very original. I also want to mention that Taylor Page plays Zola. And if you saw Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, she was Dussie May. But of course, you know, the person that people are really going to focus on when they talk about this movie is Riley Keough, who is Lisa Marie Presley's daughter and, of course, Elvis Presley's granddaughter. Now, Mike, we are kind of coming sort of to the end of our show. I did want to get your take on Riley Keough in this role and how much time you spent saying to yourself while watching this, wow, she looks like her mom, and wow, she looks like Elvis.
Well, fortunately, you know, I thought of all that, but I didn't get hung up on it because the story itself does have a freshness. It really charges ahead. It's an eye opener in a lot of ways. But again, it's a mixed blessing. Coming from a Twitter literary ancestry, you know, it does have a kind of jittery quality and edgy in terms of social media. Maria, I'm agreeing with you completely. However, by the same token, when the film doesn't seem consistent, when it's kind of uneven and kind of lurches from one thing to another, that also kind of betrays its origins there. And ultimately, the disappointment is there's no consistent tone or point of view in this film. It's sort of like, you know, has an eye opener of a scene and then it cuts to something else and then a character reappears and it's jumpy, it's jittery that way. Again, like a lot of social media, but when you watch that at feature length, maybe it's just me who has somewhat different expectations by way of shaping the material and working with it.
I will say I did think that I was very daring of Riley Keough to play that role rather than play the safer Zola, I see what's going on, but I'm somehow above it, rather than, you know, the person that's sort of dragged into it. And so far into it, they don't even see where they are in it. And I also, I wanted to point out to people who go to see the movie or eventually see it on Amazon Prime when it, you know, inevitably becomes available, that all the foul language that makes up the screenplay is completely represented in the Twitter thread. That if you read through it, it is every bit as profane as what you see on the screen. So, you know, this is just reality in terms of what they're trying to portray from the actual original source. I can't believe we're actually saying original source about the Twitter feeds, Mike, but here we are. But that does bring us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.